Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ramblecast. I am your host, Chris Cesarano, and joining me from after a long time, my good friend Phil.
Howdy.
And we have another special guest this week from a different podcast. This time, it's Ryan from the Magic Hour podcast.
We've just flipped universes. You were on our show just a couple weeks ago and stepped through the portal. Here I am here. Yep. Thanks for having me on.
And the biggest reason I invited Ryan and don't tell Eugene, was because when we were in that guest episode, I had already been brainstorming doing an episode about violence, different kinds of violence in games and stuff like that. And you made some, you said some things, it might have been during, when you were talking about the Jurassic World film, that, you know, kind of seemed appropriate. It was like, okay, this is actually relevant to the to what I want to discuss, because I don't want to discuss things like what effects violence has, like whether violence makes us horrible or anything like that. But as I've grown older, I've noticed my own responses to violence has changed. And I guess for a little bit of background, when I was a little kid, I actually used to, like, if I knew something was going to be bloody, I would actively leave the room, which afforded my parents and my older brother and everything a little bit of leeway in being able to watch PG-13 and R-rated movies with me around, because I would leave on my own. They didn't have to worry about me seeing something that I shouldn't,
quote unquote. No one needed to shield your eyes. You just got up and walked away.
And when I first saw Jurassic Park around the age of 7 or 8, I shielded my eyes a lot in that movie. Turns out I didn't need to, and I didn't after that. But no, I mean, I was actually very afraid of blood and gore when I was a little kid, until when I was about middle school, I started seeing, I think, one of the first R-rated movies I saw in full, unedited, was actually Speed. And it was Dennis Hopper losing his head that made me realize gore wasn't always actually that gross, because it looked kind of comedic and even fake. So shortly after that, though, I mean, I saw stuff like Saving Private Ryan, which is still rough for me to go back to. We might get into that. I think I've already gotten into it a bit before. And, you know, growing up, it's like I used to draw my sketchbooks, like dinosaurs eating other dinosaurs, you know, pulling at the entrails and everything. So, you know, I ended up getting more interested in gore, started watching the Alien films, started watching the Predator films, got into all this stuff, even started getting into more horror, to the point where in college I was watching some of the stuff like Saw and all that, which even then, like, that stuff wasn't that bad. And now as an adult, even stuff that's not very bloody might make me cringe and make me go, no, I don't want any of that. And maybe it's the way it's, and what I want to try and get into is maybe it's the way it's done, portrayed, and maybe it's just certain things kind of hashtag trigger me, you know, in a sense. So to get a little bit of background, Phil, like, what has your background been when it comes to growing up with violent media? And I do want to clarify as well, part of what did this was actually a discussion where, you know, I'll play violent video games like Call of Duty and Devil May Cry and the Darksiders game, like anything with blood and violence and stuff. I'll play all that stuff where you mutilate enemies, and yet I see the trailer for the new Fatal Frame game, and the way a young woman has her throat cut, like the way it's portrayed, makes me think, geez, that's really violent. As opposed to having just seen the Doom trailer and being like, oh yeah, it's bloody, and not really, like, thinking anything of it. So, Phil, how about your background, you know, growing up with violence or not, or what?
Well, I started at the Predator and Doom level. I was, you know, I was never really squeamish about it, and I actively campaigned my parents to let me watch the R-rated movies. And the first one I actually saw was the first Predator movie, and that was awesome. And I had an older brother who shared the family computer, and he bought the Doom game, the first copy of Doom that we had. So I started there, and I got to the horror stuff because Halloween was always my favorite holiday, and that's what you watched on Halloween. You know, you kind of watched the classics or slashers, so you kind of start with those. But I kind of moved out from there, and actually, I just wanted to make the point. First Saw movie, not actually very bloody at all. If you ever go back and watch that, there's like nothing in there. It's all implication.
I heard a rumor, so don't take this as fact. I heard a rumor that they actually like originally got a PG-13 rating, so they had to insert blood into the movie to make it R.
I haven't heard anything about that, but
it might be completely false. So you know, fact check me if you want, because I'm too lazy to do it. Internet's at my fingertips. I'm too lazy to fact check. But that's something that I heard. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not a very bloody film at all. But it's like some of the later ones started to get more bloody. But even then, like, it's basically cringe factor is what it goes for. You actually bring up a good point. Like, when I think of the first truly bloody video game that I played, because I was mostly a console gamer, and the first one that came about for me was Mortal Kombat, and I was thoroughly unimpressed, and one of the reasons was because the blood didn't even look interesting. It was like big lops, and I didn't find it gross. I didn't find it interesting. I didn't find it entertaining. I just thought it was stupid, and I didn't like the game mechanics. So I was one of the few kids that everyone else was like, Mortal Kombat's great, and I'm like, Street Fighter's better. So how about you, Ryan?
Boy, it's something when you sit and listen to other people talk, you go, wait, I have a pretty sordid history with violent media. My first game was probably Mortal Kombat on the SNES, but that didn't have the blood in it, did it? So I guess it wasn't that bad. I saw Jurassic Park when it came out. I was in third grade. Favorite movie of all time. And that didn't bother me at all. I still don't feel like that's really all that violent, the original Jurassic Park. But so watching the original Jurassic Park led to me seeking other dinosaur films, and at the point, one most widely available was, what was it called, Carnosaur? I don't know if anybody is familiar with that film. I hear laughing. You know what I'm talking about?
I've heard of it. I haven't watched the whole thing.
Well, it's a horrible movie, but God, it is gory. Like, dinosaurs chest busting through people, just visceral carnage, and there I was, fourth grader, watching these films totally unaffected. And definitely watching the horror films at that point, at that stage. I couldn't tell you which, though. But I know I like Gremlins, but that wasn't violent. I can remember some blood and some gore at that point. The
Gremlin was shoved into a blender at one point.
All right,
I remember that.
That counts. My mom and I used to watch the horror films, the kind of gory horror films. In the video games, I got into survival horror, Resident Evil, whenever that came out. Gosh, I don't know, but I was young, and I loved that series. I still vividly remember playing Resident Evil 3, like annually on Halloween. I would sit down and play Resident Evil 3 as a youngster. And, you know, top-down Grand Theft Auto was, you know, quote-unquote violent, but certainly not realistic as it is today. But, you know, I've played all those games, excepting 5. I think that maybe it, as I've gotten older, I've mellowed on how much, maybe not, because like now I'm playing Borderlands, but the type of violence I'll take in is a little bit different. And my reaction to it has certainly changed as I've gotten gotten older, and having children has changed the perception, I think, as well. So
you brought up two different things that definitely like I have conversed about lately. And one of them was actually like, again, like, you and I, we both grew up with Jurassic Park. I even read the books, and the books get into a lot more detail.
Oh my gosh, yeah, John Hammond. You can't spoil that book at this point. Hammond's death on the outside of his bungalow alone. Oh.
No, his was actually one of the least gore. I'm even thinking of The Lost World, where the one guy, I can't remember his name, Dodson, just dropped into the baby T-Rex nest.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like describing his cheek getting torn off and stuff. Like, oh yeah, man, those books got into some gritty detail. And I read
Henry
those
Wu,
as a kid.
The Henry Wu.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Raptors. Oh.
Yeah. It's like you remember some of those details, but we should
just be careful here, Chris, because I will accidentally turn this into the Jurassic Park cast.
So I clearly read the wrong Michael Crichton. I read Sphere.
You know what? I like that book, so shut up.
No, it was a good book. It wasn't nearly as gory, but I guess you weren't after it for that. It was fantastic. I liked it.
It was a good book. He had his on and offs when it came to writing. I think he got crazy as he got older as part of the problem. But back to the topic at hand, Jurassic Park, though, I mean, again, like, that's the thing. When I watched that as a kid, again, like, the first time we saw it in theater, my hands are over my eyes the whole time, like, every time something happened. But then we saw it in theater again.
So you were Lex. You were afraid.
Okay, yeah.
What happened to the goat?
But
there was actually a show. I want to bring this up while you're still talking about Jurassic Park. There was actually a show that was on Discovery Channel back in the day called Movie Magic, and I used to watch a ton of that. And before I saw the Jurassic Park movie, I saw the episode they did where they showed you how they made all the effects in Jurassic Park.
Oh,
so I was kind of pre-immune to it.
I'm not sure how I would have taken that as a kid. I would have loved to see it, but at the same time, it definitely would have ruined it.
And knowing about the special effects, you have, kind of have a whole different perspective on those sorts of things.
And I don't want to go too much into it. Maybe Ryan and I could do a Jurassic Park podcast sometime in the future.
I would love
to discuss it. But, I mean, at the very least, just, you know, seeing the movie a second time in theaters and missing the beginning, unfortunately. I watched it again, and it's like, oh, wow, this is no worse than the Rancor in Jedi. So, yeah. you get, it's like, yeah, it's not very bloody, it's not really gory because it's PG-13, and as a kid, you know, I'm 7 or 8 years old, I didn't know what PG-13 meant, I didn't know what the, you know, different levels of gore were, or violence, so I watched it though, and I was like, oh, that's not bad, and then like, if I was writing a story, if I was playing with my action figures, my favorite way to kill people would be by having them get eaten by my dinosaur toys. And now as an adult, that's actually, like, and I think part of it is, like, you mentioned watching that Carnosaur movie and all this horrible stuff's happening. I think you just don't have the context in your mind for what that is really like. Because now, like, the very idea of being eaten by something is one of those things that just, that's the kind of thought that'll keep me up at night. And one of the movies that actually was not ruined for me. It's just I will never own it because of one scene. And it's a scene of a guy getting eaten alive. And it's the movie Outlander. Really awesome movie about, like, a guy, like, an alien in Viking times. And it's it sounds like a terrible sci-fi original movie, but it is actually done really well, has really good direction, really good special effects. It has Ron Perlman in it as a Viking. Like, it's just a really good movie, but, like, that one shot of that guy being eaten alive, and it's not like he's, like, screaming either. It's like, you can tell, like, his body's, like, barely hanging on. It's got the chemicals to his brain. He's going to die. It's just he's still alive to see what's happening. And that's the kind of thing that's like, you know what, I can't do it anymore. Like, if... Like, again, I bought Jurassic Park on Blu-ray because I was interested in seeing the movie, just not Jurassic World. And I sat down and I watched it again, and I did not find any character death as entertaining as I used to when I was a kid. I don't know. Like, and that's the thing. That's what I'm wondering is, like, as we get older, do certain things change based on our perception of the world and what that, like, do we gain a context for that violence? Has there been anything that you used to, like, when you were a kid, be like, yeah, or something, or think was great, and now you look at it and there's just like a nope, 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 nope. Like, you don't find the entertainment value in it anymore.
Starship Troopers is the first movie I remember watching, and I watched it years after it was released. I think I found it in college or very late high school, and there's a scene in it. They're training, the soldiers are training, and it's a live fire exercise, and one of the guys' face gets shot, and just my memory of it is maybe wrong, but I remember it just looking really like, oh, this kind of looks like what maybe this actually looks like if this happens to a human being, and that struck a chord with me. That's definitely the first time I can recall going, oh, I don't think I want to watch this anymore.
About how old, you know, you said, like, college age?
This was late high school or early college.
Yeah, that's also a Paul Verhoeven film, so he's the guy that did RoboCop, which that's another film that took me a while to see because I remember people discussing how legendary the gore was in that. And it's really mostly, like, a couple of scenes. Like, it's not really, oh, no, I guess maybe it is the entire film because that one dude basically explodes at the end. But yeah, I mean that Paul Verhoeven's a guy that does not shy away from going over the top with his blood. And Starship Troopers, I mean, that was a film that I think that also kind of ruined it for me too. Amongst other things, I'm not one of those people that actually really enjoys and loves that movie. What about you, Phil? What are your thoughts on Starship Troopers?
I thought Starship Troopers was an awesome movie.
That's
not
what
necessarily
a lot of
because
are.
of
not the
graphic content. It was fun.
And I feel like that's what a lot of people actually got out of it. But I guess to push this another way, though, so I didn't even ask you. So how about for you? Like, is there any kind of, like, violence that you used to, like, find entertaining or something? Or, like, there's just something where you saw it and you're like, nope.
I don't think I've had, you know, I can't think of anything where I've rewatched something that I used to like or that I used to think was one way and had a significant shift one way or another. there are certain parts of the modern horror landscape that I take issue with that I just don't like.
Well, detail it.
That would be the French. There's a film movement called the New French Extremism.
Oh boy.
They kind of decided to take what Eli Roth was doing with Hostel, tracing back to realistically violent movies from the 80s, like Cannibal Holocaust, and just turn it on to 11, and just make it as utterly pointlessly violent as they possibly could. Just as in your face, this is the reality of doing this sort of thing with no reason to it.
Now, that's interesting because in my mind, part of the thing about horror is in a lot of ways it's about getting to, you know, our anxieties, our own cultural anxieties, our social, our personal anxieties, like all these different aspects of just anxieties in general. And that's what makes them fascinating, where you look at them through time and you can see different, or even like until recently, like you didn't have a lot of ghosts in media for the past several days, like not in mainstream American horror at least, but then Japanese horror, most of it is ghosts and poltergeists and like undead and stuff like that. And it seems very interesting how, like, in America, it's usually something like an alien creature or it's a psychotic killer. And now it's shifted around, I mean, with the popularity of, remaking stuff like The Ring and The Grudge. And then you have Paranormal Activity and you have all these different – you have the remakes of Poltergeist now. I feel like ghosts are kind of coming back in American horror culture. But for a while there, they were less frequent. It was less common for that. And then I feel like in the 70s, even then, like where you have something like The Omen come around, there's even some supernatural kind of stuff. So you can actually look back to where these things come around.
Well, it's somewhat cyclical. I mean, if you going back to the 70s, how you were mentioning the Omen and like Rosemary's Baby, the kind of Roman Polanski artfully done supernatural came to popularity as a reaction to to the really kind of, over the top, I don't know if that's the term that I want to use, the movies like the Hammer movies from the 50s and the 60s that were just like, look at all this crazy spewing Technicolor red. And then, you know, people kind of got sick of, you know, they overdosed on it.
You might have to specify Hammer movies.
Hammer was the British production studio that made a lot of classic monster movies. They did Dracula. They did a lot of Dracula, a lot of Wolfman, a lot of The Mummy. But they were in color. They were the color ones. They were the ones with Peter Cushing and
So they weren't what are usually considered the classic ones with like Christopher Lee, you know, the Universal.
They were Christopher Lee.
Was Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee was Hammer. Universal was like Boris Karloff.
Oh, wow, really? Oh, wow.
If it was in color and Dracula, it was probably Hammer. And they would
show my lack
focus
of information
on the violence. They would point out, you know, they would use the bright, comically colored blood. And, you know, it got to the point where they were doing it for that so that they could show you these crazy bloody scenes And then it kind of came around and nobody really wanted to watch that anymore. And, you know, Rosemary's Baby was coming out and these more supernatural, subtle, artfully done ones. And then we kind of went back through that in the slashers and then, you know, the Sam Raimi stuff in the 80s with, you know, Evil Dead and just gallons of blood all over the place. And then we kind of brought it back and it's all cyclical.
Yeah, like one of the things that recently came out is supposed to be It Follows, which is evidently not a very violent film, but a lot of people find it to be very creepy and frightening. And I've heard spoiler podcasts about it. It does sound fascinating. I want to see it, but a lot of people say it's like a quote-unquote old school, I think, 80s kind of film, but without being a throwback.
I haven't seen it, so I'm only speaking from what I've heard about it. Borrows a lot from the 80s, not necessarily the traditions, but the culture. There's a lot of 80s-ish sounding music and a lot of 80s-ish fashion in it. There's actually a very interesting video review and analysis of it done by a guy named Leon Thomas, who runs a show called Renegade Cut. And he ties it back. His theory is that It Follows is actually about the inevitability of the progression of time, old age, and death.
That's one of the major interpretations I've heard, yeah.
And that, you know, the crux of the movie is around sexual activity, but it's framed as a loss of innocence.
Yeah, and that's like part of, like, you're right, I mean, the horror there, again, it's not actually violent, which is interesting in that a lot of, you're right, it's cyclical. I mean, a lot of films, like, the horror becomes the violence, and then it's not like, I mean, when you think about, like, Alien, the violence of the chest burster and stuff like that, like, you think about it as sort of a response to the frightening idea of pregnancy. Normally it's viewed as, like, you know, a male's fear of something like pregnancy and just the violation of sex and such as that, but considering, like, even some female friends I've had, I'd say female friends I know are even more freaked out by that kind of stuff, oddly enough. So it seems like it can be a universal concept, a universal sort of, like, exploration of, you know, this is a normal biological thing, but isn't it kind of, like, freaky? I mean, this thing is growing inside of you. And Alien reflects on that. So the violence is kind of a product of that fear. It's that fear taken to an extreme.
That your own creation will eventually destroy you.
Yeah.
To an extreme, but to an unnatural way as well. And I think that's why a lot of the films that, Phil, your wonderful cinematic history lesson, you were telling us about that, those don't bother me, because it's a lot of that is okay, that's probably not going to happen. Yes, okay, maybe a zombie apocalypse will occur one day, but for the most part we don't have to worry about these kinds of things occurring in reality. Chris, you brought up what causes the change in our perception, and with experience in, I know, my life, comes that understanding of what a death is and what a death impacts. And I'm thinking about the M. Night
Shyamalan.
M. Night Shyamalan, sorry. What was the movie with the alien? Signs?
Signs, yes.
All right, so there's a scene where the husband or the wife is impaled with a truck, right?
The wife
impaled with a truck, and her body is cut in half, and the only thing holding her together is the force of the truck, and the main
character, as soon as they pull the truck away, everything's going to fall apart.
Right. So you didn't see that. You don't see any of the gore, but that was a scene that was, oh my God, that really was another one of those, oh, that, nope. because that, I can, whatever in my brain connect that there's a whole family that's now affected by that. The husband that is, you know, emotionally destroyed by that. And it's something that unfortunately could and does happen in reality. It's not a zombie tearing somebody in half, it's a vehicle.
And you know what? I think that is actually the real good point when it comes to portrayals of violence, is that, like, right now, just thinking back to two different things. Saving Private Ryan, one of the characters dies by being stabbed, and that that scene haunts me, man. Like, just that character's death. Like, it's one of those things that the way it's shown, it's shown in a way where it looks slow, it looks painful, and it looks like it hasn't left me since I saw it in theaters. It's one of those things where it's like, I know it's fake, but I don't ever want to see that again. And yet, I'll watch The Lord of the Rings, where people and monsters are getting, like, stabbed left and right, and it comes down to just the atmosphere and, like, the nature of it. It's like, how is this violence being portrayed? And you think back to the end of The Fellowship of the Ring, you know, you watch an orc get a knife in his thigh, but he just, like, kind of, like, grunts it off. It's like, oh, you know, flesh wound. You see him get his arm chopped off and then stabbed, and he just pulls it back into himself. Like, it's not very heavily focused on. It's very over the top, and it's basically breaking reality. It's violence as portrayed in a sort of... It's mythical, is the best way I can think to put it. It's violence portrayed in a mythical manner of larger-than-life characters. And
whereas in Saving Private Ryan, Chris, I mean, that could have happened to somebody on a battlefield.
Exactly. That's stuff that could... And it's set right in the beginning. You're seeing people in shock. You're seeing people holding their intestines and crying for their mother. Like, from the very beginning, you're hearing these boys, like, you're hearing them in pain. You're hearing them, like... their last moments, how their body, you know, rational thought leaves. All they can think is, like, they want reassurance before they die. You hear that they don't want to die versus, you know, oh, look, red shirt number 3 just got shot, goes down, and he's gone. There's no pain. There's no, like, even the scream is, the scream is probably a Wilhelm scream these days. it's not like, legitimately painful. It doesn't sound legitimately painful. So it's something where you get a sense of stakes, but not enough. So it's like where your brain's able to register. It's like, okay, this is fake, so this can be entertainment. And Jurassic Park, to go back, actually, I feel like draws an interesting line in between, because it's very much still stylized and fake. I mean, You don't get much of the lawyer's death. The way even Nedry dies is kind of stylized.
He's got a like a pan whistle sound effect when he's about to hit it.
He's got an interesting scream, man. But that's the thing. Like he is a stylized, the way he's screaming and the car is rocking and everything. And
I thought, like, Nedry got eaten in the outhouse.
That was Gennaro. The blood-sucking lawyer.
Oh, Nedry's the fat guy, yeah. Nedry's me. I want him as Nedry's a Halloween Newman. One time.
Yeah. Sorry, it's been a long time since I've seen Jurassic Park.
Yeah. It's still a good movie, surprisingly, but we'll talk about that in another podcast. But that's the thing, it's the way it's, and that's where I think for The Lost World, my reaction to violence, like, again, like, this is stuff I've been thinking of for the past few months, actually. Like, before even Jurassic World came out, like, I was thinking about this stuff. So The Lost World, you know, I feel like that's where they kind of turned a lot of it up to more towards entertainment. Like, you have the long grass where people are just getting sucked under and you see the raptor tail. And it's like, that's not how someone would really be, killed that way in real life. But it's stylized. It's like, okay, these guys are all bad guys. They're okay to die, so we're able to enjoy. And, like, it's going to be done in a stylized kind of fashionable way.
Well, there's a certain amount of, are you doing it to prove a point, or are you doing it because it's for the story?
And that's where,
you know, you have 30 seconds of film. Do you you're Peter Jackson, you have 30 seconds of film. Do you shoot Legolas shooting 5 orcs, or do you spend 30 seconds watching Gandalf fall? You know, one just proves a point that Legolas is a badass, or that there's a lot of enemies here and it's a really tough battle. And the other one is, this character who you know and have connected with is done.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point, too.
And that comes to horror a lot. There's a lot of criticism of horror comes to, you know, these guys are all assholes, we don't care, but the best ones will make good characters that you don't want to see hurt, and then hurt them.
And that's actually one of the things that did bother me about, and that's where I was partially going with The Lost World, because at the very end, like towards the very end when the T-Rex is on a rampage, there is one guy, and I'll always remember that one guy that tries to run into a store, and the like he's just a random guy, random nobody, you know, complete innocent, quote unquote, in movie terms, and the T-Rex grabs him, and it lingers, like, on his scream. The T-Rex snaps his jaws. You hear the crunch. You hear his voice change to a strangle. Like, and it lingers on this guy's death, and he's a random nobody. And I hear that there's a much worse death in Jurassic World, and I've heard the details very much, and it's actually enough to make me disinterested, because it's like, why... Like, this is a film that you're supposedly, like until now, has just been fun adventure.
Oh, and it's now a character that had more development in the free-to-play mobile game than had in the movie, too.
So, it's like, and they just, be it Jurassic World, this one character, or The Lost World, it's like, you're trying to create a film, like, that thus far has been like, oh, it's nice Hollywood fluff. You know, nothing's too serious. We don't have to be reminded about the harshness of reality. We get to escape it. And yeah, someone's not about to get eaten by a T-Rex, but you're introducing a dose of reality of what that might be like and how unpleasant it will be. And that's the kind of thing that will take me out of some of these films and honestly does kind of bother me. And it's more for me. And it's not like I might, now that I think about it, sound like I'm trying to say I dislike realistic violence, but that's not true. Like, I love that Saving Private Ryan exists because of, like, what it's doing with that violence. And there are films where, I wish I could come up with one on the top of my head, but there are times where, I mean, it's something you can, I can appreciate the way it's done, or, like, Boondock Saints is another example. Like, there's one moment that, for some reason, the way it's done is, maybe it's because of the characters, that is actually kind of, it's as equally disturbing as it is touching in some ways, where they clear out, like, I mean, because this is a movie where people watch it because they think it's funny and everything, and it's, you know, basically guys trying to kill these gangsters and stuff, but there is one scene where it's very quiet, you hear the solemn music, and it's kind of slow-mo, and the one character walks up to a guy who's filled with bullet holes, but he's not dead yet, and he basically just walks up, covers his eyes or either his mouth or his eyes, and plugs him in the heart to, you know, make it, you know, quick to end it. And you get the sense that the character doesn't actually enjoy killing him. So it's a little dose of reality that, yeah, someone could be full of bullet holes, not wanting to die, but it's still able to be done in a way that it doesn't break me out of the movie. I'm able to accept that what they're doing because of the way the character is responding. It seems like it's, you know, reflecting that for these characters, they understand the cost of death. They understand, and they're not doing this maliciously, that even though this guy's, you know, they're killing these people, but he's like, okay, you're full of holes. We're not going to leave you here to just be in pain and suffer. I'm going to put you out of your misery. I mean, it might sound like now I'm rationalizing it, but it's like there are different ways of portraying it, so you can introduce a little bit of reality in your, you know, little popcorn fun flick. But it feels like it depends on who it's happening to, how it's portrayed, and how the rest of the world reacts, I guess.
Well, these are moments that, obviously, they're very impactful to some of the viewers. They're impactful to us. So it's a testament to maybe not just good storytelling, but good filmography or cinematography, I guess is the appropriate term.
Cinematography would be it, yeah.
These moments, though they might be a little painful to watch, they are burned in our brains, for better or worse. And so the films that do them in that meaningful way, you know, they're probably okay.
Yeah. Well, it does make me wonder, like, is there anything that, like, because again, like, for me, like, one of the big things is being eaten alive kind of a thing. And generally, like, anything where it does linger on, like, someone's suffering, and it doesn't seem to be for any purpose other, like, again, like, Outlander, that guy's suffering, it feels like there was no reason for it to be in that movie other than maybe the film director thought, it would be cool to have that dose of reality. I mean, I don't know. It's like, it wasn't really a particularly horrifying film. The rest of the violence was just over the top and, you know, your typical like entertaining like stuff where it's like quick flashes of maybe gore or something, but it's like no, not like lingering on suffering. And then all of a sudden there's this one scene and it's like, oh, well, thank you for that. As I watch this creature tear at like the guy's stomach muscle, like it's like, and he's gasping there. Like it's like, it's, I don't understand why for something like that there, it's like jarring. Is there anything for you guys where it's like anything that I guess hashtag triggers you? Like, do people suffocating get you or something like that? Drowning, for example.
Generally, I think, and recently it's kids dying. My wife and I watch Major Crimes, and this is a show that's, it's a crime drama, probably comparable to many others. And every now and then there's an episode where, you know, there's a dead kid. And that is, we both just look at each other when we see a kid introduced and it's like, please tell me the kid's not going to die. So again, it seems like I'm stuck in, and now the stage I'm in my life, it's the realistic ones that I can connect with personally. And I can empathize with the characters that go through the loss that really affect me. That's probably the only phobia. And realistic blood, I don't so much like. I don't like to see things behave as it seems like they would in real life. Like Starship Troopers struck me in that one scene is, oh, that looks like how somebody's eye would actually move in that. The physics seem really realistic, you know?
Yeah.
How about you, Phil? Nope.
Yeah, you mentioned the French film stuff, and that, well, that sounds like the entire purpose of that is lingering on the painful realities of death, but maybe even like is it not even like is it even like just we're going to make sure these people die in as excruciating a manner as possible?
Well, the thing about these is that they have very small casts. The movie that I probably dislike the most is called Martyrs. And the basic premise of the movie is that there is a cult, a philosophical cult, that believes that if you torture someone enough, they will be in enough excruciating agony to transcend the bounds of reality and see the universe in its true form and give you some true and perfect insight to life. And that's the point of the movie. And there are like three characters, one of whom dies within, you know, one of whom commits suicide within the first, I don't know, half hour. And then they spend the rest of the movie beating and flaying one character just because it might work. And then there's, it ends, and I'm going to spoil it because I hate this movie, but it ends with the leader of the cult being told the universal truth because it works, and then realizing that it was all pointless. So the movie literally turns back on itself and was like, yeah, everything that we just did had absolutely no reason to it.
I feel like there are a couple reasons to make a film, like what kind of a message you could be trying to convey, but I think I understand what you mean. Like there's many better ways to go about it.
Yeah, it was just because of where the movie put its focus. You know, those are points. Those are legitimate points that you could make, but as a movie, it was like, yeah, let's torture. And there was another one.
It sounds like its whole message is, this is all just a bunch of pointless violence for the sake of being pointless.
Yeah.
Well, I can even see it being basically like if you want to be kind to it, the extreme and ignorant lengths people will go to for some idea of transcend, like just an answer, like for what they think is a worthwhile goal. And in the end, it's not worth it.
And yeah,
It feels like the film itself is that thing. It's like you went through all of this grisly, visual, like empathetic torture, and it wasn't even worth it. But it's like, that's so fuck. That's just so meta. I don't know. Like, that's, yeah, I feel like that would not be. It's, hey, you're trying to make an artistic point that way, if that is what they're trying to do, but it's like, no, it's still like, no.
Yeah. There are points there, and I'll discuss that. You know, I would talk about that, but as a movie, I hate it. Because there's no point. The characters that are being hurt are completely innocent. They have.
Oh, so wait, were they not even, like, volunteers to be tortured?
No, they were kidnapped during childhood.
Wow!
Oh, boy.
And then one of them got away, murdered a random family, but it was okay because it was connected to the cult. So you kind of have both things going on in the same movie. You have people that deserve to die dying quickly, and you have people that don't deserve to die dying slowly and horribly.
That's magical.
Now, I guess the acts in these films, are they done in a way that when you watch them, you really have to ask, how did they manage to film this to the degree of realism that it has? Or
that's part of the whole aesthetic of the French movement, is that they are incredibly realistic.
And I would not be surprised.
I will not watch any of these films.
Yeah, I can give you a list of movies to avoid, but no, that's the whole point, is that they're incredibly realistic, and they're just, I don't know, they just drop it on the floor right in front of you and being, this is violence, look.
And it seems like,
as opposed to trying to entertain at all.
It's a fascination with, in some ways, the special effects, gore even, like how realistic can you get this fake stuff to look, and I'm not interested in fake. With few exceptions, I'm not interested in that. But let's actually switch gears for a minute, because we've been talking a lot about film, and we've been talking about our reactions to that kind of media. Now let's switch it back over to video games. And are there video games that you guys have ever had at a point where you were just like, no, I will not do this in this game because that is too brutal?
I almost hit it in Heavy Rain. Almost.
I'm trying to remember. Would that be a spoiler to discuss?
I'm not sure. I mean, Heavy Rain's an older game.
At this point, it is. I feel like if you wanted to play it, you'd have played it by now. But I think it's getting HD PS4 remasters. I think they mentioned that, so I have no idea.
Well, if we go by that philosophy, we can't ever talk about any video game ever.
Okay. It's getting ported to virtual console. We can't talk about it. Discuss.
I haven't played Heavy Rain, so Phil, please, spoil it for me. If you're worried about being spoiled about Heavy Rain, mute.
Discuss as vaguely as possible.
Yeah. Well, Heavy Rain, there's three characters that you play as in Heavy Rain.
More than that, like four, isn't there?
No, there's only three. There's Ethan, there's the detective, and there's the woman. I forget
there's
which
the FBI agent, the detective.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Nam and Jaden. Completely forgot him. He has some uncomfortable moments too, but they're not necessarily violent. They're drug related. Now the one that I had some trouble with is there are a couple of points when you're playing through Ethan's storyline where he has to, and you have to make him do pretty grievous physical harm to himself. There's one point where
to himself, okay, yeah,
you
okay,
have to cut off your own finger.
I actually, if I recall, you don't have to do that.
I think if you delay and try to avoid it long enough that you can get out of it.
That's one of those moments where, yeah, the game is very interesting like that. No, I know what you're talking about, though, and yeah, I can see that. There is also Dead Space Extraction. You're forced to cut off your own hand. Oh, Dead Space 2. Dead Space 2. Are you nervous about stuff near your eyeball?
That just looked cartoony. I thought that was hilarious.
Heavy Rain, even though it's this disembodied character. No,
the character was fully there. It's the violence in Dead Space is so cartoony.
I was saying Dead Space again, totally.
Dead Space revels in it.
Totally fake. Like, okay, the zombies on a spaceship. This isn't really going to happen.
It's not even the monster. It's like you can vaguely see some level of humanity in the monsters. Like, vaguely. It's like, okay, there's technically human being in there, but for the most part, it's just a monster. And then when Isaac dies, it's so over the top.
Spoilers, dude!
No, I mean, like, game over screens.
Oh, okay. Okay. But I've got Dead Space 2 sitting on my pile, man.
I quit the franchise.
Isaac dies! That's why they have Dead Space 3!
Dead Space 1, though. When a character just, like, dies real quick towards the end of the game. It was kind of, whoa, didn't expect that. And
there's a bit of a smear that happens too. But
yes, there is.
At that point, you're like, I'm glad that happened. I'd smear it too.
yeah, and it was unexpected.
It was. God, I got to replay those games. I'd buy an HD collection of them real quick. But no, I mean, actually, that brings to mind, though. Here's an example. Isaac's death. And I think part of what also makes Isaac's death animations in Dead Space cartoony is, with few exceptions, you never really see his human self. It's just a guy in a suit. So it's over the top and bloody, but you don't get to see any kind of human reaction. And then I think over to Tomb Raider, where some of poor Lara Croft's deaths are just... I don't know why they made them brutal like that, and I think that's one of my biggest questions about the new one is, am I going to be forced into a gameplay segment where I have to watch the equivalent of Lara getting impaled at the throat or chin over and over? Because there's actually a great, hilarious Conan O'Brien sketch of him playing that part of the level and dying over and over again, and it's hilarious, but... At the same time, it really is when you're playing that moment of the game, you're like, I am so sick of seeing Lara die this way. And it's, in some ways, yeah, I mean, I wonder if for some characters or for some properties, like, or again, once again, it's like, what's the intent? For Dead Space, it's, they're doing an homage to all of these over-the-top horror movie crazy deaths, where for some films, it really is about, you know, how creative and inventive can this character death really be? And yet for Tomb Raider, for what is, for the most part, I mean, it's a tense adventure, but I feel like that movie could have easily been PG-13 if it wasn't for stuff like those death animations. Well, rated teen, not PG-13, if it wasn't for those death animations. And it kind of feels like it would be more appropriate that way. So it's another tonal thing, but... thinking more to control. How about you? I mean, Ryan, we actually didn't even get to you yet. Like, is there anything, or do we get to you?
Not in the video games, like what I wouldn't do. And if I don't, I get, mine is all really human. The more human these scenarios are, the more likely I am to stay away from it. I don't play military shooters. And so honestly, I'm not even going to really talk about what I think Call of Duty is. I think Call of Duty is probably a little too real for me. I don't know because I haven't played them since Modern Warfare. They just grounded too much in the real world. Now Halo, sure, I love that.
Aside from the big nuclear moment, I can't think of much in the way of death in Call of Duty that didn't feel Hollywood.
Yeah, I might actually enjoy the games. As I said, I'm not going to sit here and critique it because I don't have the experience anymore with them to make that opinion, but I tend to stay away from those. Now, if to get maybe slightly deeper, Far Cry 2 I just recently played. And there's a game with quite a bit of violence, and it's I guess older now, so not hyper realistic, but you're a terrible human being in that game. And there was just something about it that compelled me to push forward with it. And it's definitely a game I wouldn't normally pursue, but, you know, the violence in games, it's a power fantasy to a degree, right? Like, there would be days I'd come home from work, it's like, oh man, what a crummy day. I'm in a bad mood. I'm looking forward to being a real jerk. And being able to play Far Cry 2 for a short burst, because after about an hour of that, it's like, okay, I'm being a real horrible person. I gotta change this up. But yeah, there were some moments in that were rough.
For those that read my blog, they will know that I actually do take some issue with the use of the term power fantasy. I feel like it is very overused because, I guess for me, like one of the things that comes to me isn't so much power fantasy but mechanics for a game. And I feel like one of the things that gets in the way of an emotional attachment to a game is the actual mechanics of playing it and therefore how you see the game world. And it is a complete detachment from reality. For example, playing a game like Infamous, I blow up an APC and all of a sudden it turns out a bystander was too close. And now any progress I made towards using unleashing my super attack is completely wiped away because I get negative karma. And now I don't think of that innocent life that was just lost as an innocent life lost. I think of it mechanically. It's like it's punishment for not executing this gameplay perfectly, and therefore I don't get the reward. I don't get the reward of unleashing an awesome power. And therefore I am removed from having any sort of real emotional attachment to the denizens of this world. And a lot of games I feel like wrap up in that sort of mechanical thought process. Even when it's not a heavily mechanics-focused game, I was playing, I shall not name it, even though I'm sure plenty of people can guess, I was playing a adventure game where I had to prevent someone from doing great harm to themselves. And it was more for mechanical reasons that I wanted to talk them out of it, using the game options. It's basically like, okay, what's the correct choice here? What's going to work the best based on my previous choices. And I don't want them to put great harm to themselves because that would probably have negative repercussions in the future events of the game. And therefore, it's not so much out of caring about the character, though there is that too. But a lot of it is just very mechanically minded. And this is where I'm wondering, like, you know, with film, because we're observers, is it easier to therefore empathize, whereas in a video game, again, like you say, power fantasy, but for me, video games, I mean, that violence and stuff, violence is an easy form of conflict to create mechanics around, and once you create mechanics around it, how do you get someone to care about something emotionally when instead they're all, I mean, it's all about rules at that point, it's all about rewards, outcomes, you know. How do you achieve victory the most efficient way possible? And this is one of the reasons why I think Halo in some ways is even effective, because it, like all of their creative alien races are meant to fit a specific game purpose. Whereas if you're just designing a first-person shooter around human beings, you have to make a really varied, really good AI, or else you're going to get very repetitive. And it's one of the issues I think Call of Duty in some ways can have. The only thing I can think of, and this would be the second week in a row I'd mention it, is Spec Ops The Line, where you start off, you know, like if you do a melee attack, it's very quick, very professional. Towards the end of the game, your characters are becoming unhinged, and if you do a melee kill, on someone, it starts to get brutal, where it's like you're taking vengeance out on this person. And it's supposed to be disturbing because you're realizing, like, how screwed up your character is becoming, how the entire situation's screwing with their mind. And I think that is an interesting way of taking mechanics and making them disturbing over time, like, because you're going to notice it. You're going to take something that was just a simple, quick, mechanical thing to get an outcome, and now it's lingering on that outcome. Even though technically it's no different than, let's say, I'm playing Ninja Gaiden and I do an execution where he lops off an arm, lops off another arm, and then lops off the guy's head. And you see the blood spray everywhere.
Chris, you are a scary motherfucker. you just turned the death of one into a statistic.
I'm not sure where to go with that.
So you're all this mechanics, and now you made really a valid point. So how do you feel about a game like strategy RPGs like Fire Emblem or Valkyria Chronicles, which mechanically, yeah, it's fail or not fail in a lot of ways. But there's that emotional development with the characters. Well, it's okay, so that character then dies. Well, I guess you just restart the game and then go and ensure that that person doesn't die, right? Does that lose for you do you lose the emotion there, or?
I think that's an interesting combination, and I actually really like, in some ways, I like the intertwining of mechanics and narrative in that regard, because there are some characters where it's like, I like you too much. I'm sorry. You're too amusing. You're too awesome. I can't let you die. And then there were other characters where it's like, okay, I'm fed up of restarting this level over and over again. You're gone. You're gone. You're done. I'm sorry. Goodbye. But the thing is, yeah, you're right. I mean, basically, if a character was paired up with another one really well, it's mechanics, but it's like part of the reason I paired those characters up was because I liked their personalities. Like, you look at what characters they can be compatible with in some of the menu options. In Fire Emblem Awakening, I mean, I'm not... I played a little bit of Valkyria Chronicles, and no, I want to play more of it. But with Fire Emblem Awakening, I mean, you look at what characters they're compatible with, and it's like, you know what? I like this personality and this person. I think these personalities meld. And then, yeah, you enjoy watching the two characters interact. So part of it is that, you know, the mechanics kind of reinforce the idea of that investment. You know, the two characters have like all these bonuses when working together, and if one of them dies, then all those bonuses are gone. And look at how much effort you have to put into rebuilding that with someone else. Or you just reload your save. But that's the thing. Like, the mechanics actually work the same way as it would narratively. Because imagine if you have even a friend, like not even a lover, but a friend that suddenly bites it. How are you going to suddenly develop that same kind of repertoire? Not repertoire. Fuck.
Rapport.
Thank you. How are you going to develop that same kind of rapport with someone else is going to take a long time. And it is very interesting because in some ways, again, the mechanics can pull you out of it, but the mechanics can also push you into it too. And I think in some ways, if done right, certain escort quests can actually be the same. Like for me, I find it interesting that in Resident Evil 4, I do not hate Ashley. I kind of like Ashley, whereas everyone else hates her. I kind of like Ashley because if I tell her to hide in something, she hides in something. If I turn around and point my gun somewhere in her direction, she ducks. She knows to get out of the way. I mean, it is an interesting way to attach you to a complete AI character, and yet at the same time, people couldn't stop looking at Ashley as a person and basically just be sitting there, you stupid, blah, 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 why won't you, blah, 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 and just hate the fact that they have to take care of this other person. And there are other video games like that where you're in charge of taking care of something, and then it either becomes, you know, it becomes a source of attachment or it becomes a source of hatred. I'm trying to think of other examples. I think Yoshi's Island might be another one because I've heard so many people talk endlessly about how much they hate the cry of Baby Mario, kind of a thing. And even, you know,
if I could throw Baby Mario off the tallest cliff in all of the land, I would.
But reversing it, how about in Super Mario World, though, where, you know, you get hit and Yoshi starts running, and now, like, have you ever had that moment where you watch Yoshi run right off the cliff?
Right into the lava, poor guy.
So it's a combination of things where mechanically, like, I feel like it's like if something is useful mechanically, and the Fable dog, the Fable 2 dog, I loved that dog because he allowed me to find hidden things. So I guess
it's very goal oriented.
Granted, this is not completely violence. We've kind of gone a little bit off topic.
I'm hearing an interconnected theme here.
It's how do the mechanics either detach you from something or attach you to something.
And what is the human emotional connection?
I wanted to say, I think video games have it easier than movies. because you have a certain, generally in the video game, as long as the mechanics are relatively expressive for what you want to be trying to do, you have kind of a certain built-in attachment to your own avatar. And I think the thing that frustrates a lot of people about fetch quests is the lack of expressivity with what they're able to do and how they control their avatar within the game. There's no way to tell your companions what you want without complicated menus or a lot of problems. So they're not upset that they have to take care of it. They're upset that they can't express themselves to take care of it because they're invested in their avatar and they feel like they're trying to accomplish something and being stymied. Whereas in a movie, you have characters that you need to care about in order to get involved and invested in the storyline and experience whatever emotion you have to whatever emotion you should experience if that movie was a success. But they have to do it in a purely non-interactive format. They have to present someone to you who you cannot talk to, you know nothing about, who has to become someone who you like.
And I say that's where technically I think video games can have the advantage, but video games have the disadvantage of a lot of people not properly knowing how to write characters or how to use the medium of games to get you to care about characters.
Well, that's entirely possible. It's just they do have that advantage, is what I was saying.
When video games work in that regard, they work well. But then I remember playing Halo Reach and even Halo ODST, and it's like, I don't care if any of these characters survive or die. And in fact, in Reach, you know they're going to die because that's the story. It's, by that point, everyone knows Reach is about a bunch of characters that die. So it's one of those things where it's possible to make people care about that thing. And in a lot of ways, yeah, video game, there's more time to build that attachment because it doesn't have to be like an hour and a half to 2.5 hours. There's more time. There's the fact that you're able to engage with that character. And it even goes back, like, I was recently re-listening to some older episodes, and one of them was actually the romance one that we discussed. And we discussed a lot of time with BioWare games, and even then, like, yeah, there's a lot of time spent being attached to characters, but even then, you have to do it completely by just going through text and listening to people talk.
And you've got to do it by the book. If you mess up one choice,
oh yeah, you'd screw it up for all for a while. No, but going back to the violent things too, neither one of you guys played Modern Warfare 2, did you?
No.
I think I did. Which one was Modern Warfare 2?
Modern Warfare 2 is the one with the no Russian level.
Yeah, I played it.
And I'm trying to think if there's any other equivalent that you might have experienced, Ryan, because the thing with no Russian that was supposed to be a big deal was it had you able to play. I mean, you could skip it, but had you able to play a character that could shoot up an airport. And the thing is, you were playing a character that was technically undercover with a bunch of terrorists. So you were technically a secret agent kind of a thing. You were an infiltrator. And spoilers, at the end of the level, no matter what you do, your character is killed because they know you're actually like they know you're really not a terrorist like they are. You're really an agent and stuff like that. And I couldn't help but think, I mean, when it comes to, again, speaking of the power of video games, what would be a very, very interesting use of that scenario, even if I know a lot of people would consider it even more disgusting to do so, is if because you can go through that level without shooting anyone, or by shooting very few, or not even doing it like lethally. Like, you could shoot people in, like, I believe the leg. I don't know. Maybe the mechanics don't allow for that. Because I know some people just lie on the ground in pain and they can be, kind of put out of their misery. But I feel like a moment like that, if you really want to try and create an emotional impact for the player and really get them questioning their own values or what they would look like, just kind of get them in the gut kind of a thing, how they perform in that level would create a fork in the game's narrative where, yeah, if you don't kill people, then they know you're clearly not on the level. and so they kill you and leave you for dead. But if you do, then you can continue infiltrating them. And therefore, you have two completely different... Granted, that's hard because now you got to create two completely different games. But I feel like that's a great way to take this moment and be like, put yourself in this person's shoes. And now are you really willing to... And I didn't kill that many when I played, but it's like... I was also sitting there like, I don't necessarily feel bad about it because it's still Hollywoodized. It's like I pull the trigger and people drop. And it doesn't feel real. And that, I guess maybe that's part of it, is whereas if you want me to feel sympathy for who I'm killing, maybe they've got to behave real, which is one of the reasons I didn't play Hatred. All right, did you guys have any last things you wanted to say?
Don't watch Martyrs.
Don't watch Martyrs.
I think I'm good. I think the conversation has taken turns and twists, and that's probably okay. That's what a good conversation should do, right?
All right.
Hopefully, well, I provided some interesting background and food for thought from my perspective.
You're the film history buff over there, man. Like, I'm impressed.
Oh yeah. You made me feel ashamed, man. I always thought freaking Christopher Lee was universal. How dare I tarnish his memory? The memory of him.
Yeah,
he'll get you. He'll get you one day. He'll be waiting for you.
Some of the Universal movies, but he was definitely a Hammer guy. He was Dracula.
And I did not know that was not Universal. That's part of the issue. I need to see that movie. I need to see a bunch of Christopher Lee's old movies. But all right, folks. It sounds like that's about it for us. Maybe like most topics, I imagine most of these topics are things I can easily come back to another time, perhaps when I have a much more solidified idea of my thoughts towards violence in the media and games in general. And not like in that, how do they, like, more, it's not the idea of how they influence us, but more how we react to it is what I find fascinating, because everyone's going to be different. And I feel like anyone that you might argue has been influenced by violence, that's more their reaction, their response, and it's a reflection of who they are or how they perceive the world. I guess maybe that's where my ultimate point is. I think our responses to violence in media is simply based on who we are, kind of a thing. And again, like for me, like some of the stuff that, you know, that keeps me from watching a movie again, or might keep me from owning a movie, that's just personal stuff that will, like, it's stuff I've thought about, stuff that has bothered me, and stuff that I don't want to think about. But then there's stuff that clearly doesn't have as much of an impact on me and doesn't bother me so much. So it really comes down to, and that's where I'm partially fascinated, is I've been trying to figure out where, for me, I draw the line with this media. And that's where I wanted to bring everyone. And of course, why for video games? Like, one of the things that I brought up that I didn't mention is, like, I mean, if I'm watching a movie and you see someone, like, snap a bone, you hear the bone snap. Like, even if you don't see it, like, if you hear a bone snap, you know, I'll cringe, I'll flinch. But then playing Batman, I'm not even thinking about it, because like you hear all these bones cracking as you're beating up these thugs, and yet I'm already thinking about the next thug over there. So it doesn't give you time to really reflect on it, and that's what I'm kind of fascinated about. So if you guys have any thoughts on the matter, if you have any thoughts on violence, how you respond to violence, or even, you know, why certain kinds of violence bothers you, feel free, write ramblepacknoc64@gmail.com. Or go to facebook.com/ramblepack64 and comment, let us know. Or even if you go to gamertag.net, find the post for this episode, comment right there, even though it requires the Facebook tool. Just get in contact, let us know what you think, and review us on iTunes, of course. And meanwhile, Phil, I mean, where can people find you?
I am on Facebook, facebook.com/buildenvironment, I believe. Maybe Build Environment TV. I don't remember my own link very well. I am also on YouTube at BETV Shows, or on the tag Modern Horror. Facebook or Twitter.com/buildenviron, because usernames have to be short.
Is that it?
I think that's all of them. Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. Yeah.
All right. And how about you, Mr. Ryan? We all know. So as you're going to say, like, as I said, like you're from the Magic Hour show, which is you can find that at www.gamerparent.net.
Yeah, and once in a while I'll write something that goes up there. You know, our host runs that site and does a lot more than I do. But every couple of months a post comes up by me. But I am Zoso1701. That's Z-O-S-O. 1701 on Twitter, Miiverse, Steam. You know, feel free to. I think I have that's my PlayStation ID. You know, if I ever get a PS4, we can jam on that too. So feel free to add me on any of those. And thanks, Chris, for inviting me on to add whatever I may have added to the discussion. And I really hope we will have the Jurassic Park cast. That'd be a dream come true.
I'm going to have to see the movie eventually, I think, because I do want to discuss the series as a whole. So, all right, people. And as usual, you can also catch more of my stuff again, www.gamertag.net. And, of course, check out my YouTube channel at youtube.com/RamblePack64. Or just Google RamblePack64, no C, just like the Rumble Pack on the N64.
That's the joke.
That's the joke. Okay. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And I hope to hear from you soon. And thanks, of course, Phil and Ryan for joining me tonight.
Hey, very well.
Ramble.